Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we're going to be lifting the lid on an Aberdeen investment trust. We're going to be looking at the Shires Income Trust. We're going to be delving into the portfolio, its approach to income investing, and we're also going to be drilling down into several of the holdings within that. And to do that, we're very kindly joined today by Ian Pyle, who is the fund manager at Shires Income. Ian, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Jonathan, thank you very much for having me on. It's a great pleasure to be here and delighted to be talking about Shires.
Yes, really, really looking forward to this. This is a fascinating trust and really interesting holdings within it. But before we get into it, Ian, please could you give us an introduction, first of all, to yourself as well as Shires Income, please?
Yeah, so I'll do myself quickly first. I am a portfolio manager here at Aberdeen. I run UK income products, including Shires, and I also work on some global income funds and also run a thematic future minerals fund as well. So a fairly diverse remit. I have been here for just over 10 years, and before I joined Aberdeen, or what was then Standard Life, I was a sell-side analyst covering the energy sector, and back in the midst of time, I was a consultant and accountant as well, and qualified as a chartered engineer before that. Moving on to what matters, which is Shires. It's a UK income product. It's one we think is a bit differentiated from your standard income fund, and I'll go through the reasons for that. But the main thing we try and communicate is what we're trying to deliver for clients, and that is a high level of resilient income, but maintaining potential for growth both in income and in capital over the long term as well. And when we think about high level of income, we compare it to the UK equity benchmark, obviously. So at the moment, we're doing about 5.3% yield. The UK benchmark is about 3.5%. So it's a pretty meaningful premium. But we also look at what we're delivering compared to what your end client could get in bonds or in cash, for example. So if you look at a cash ISA at the moment, you get about 4.8%. And cash is a real competitor for equity income products again now. So we need to make sure we're delivering income that is really attractive compared to cash. And then we also want to make sure that we get all the benefit of equities in there as well. So in cash, your capital is going to be deflated over time. You're going to lose money. In equities, you get that inflation hedge. You get capital appreciation over time. And you also get growth in your income over time if we do our job properly. So putting that together, we think we end up with something which is a really compelling all-round income solution, which appeals to a lot of retail shareholders. Then when we dig into the construction of the portfolio and what we do in the trust, it's a bit different. We hold primarily UK equities. So about high 70% is UK equities. Then there's some overseas equities as well for diversification. That tends to go up and down. And then we have about 20% of the portfolio in preference shares or other fixed income assets. And the attraction of those is that they give us a really high, stable yield. On average, that bit of the portfolio yields over 7%, so double what you get on UK equities. And it's a very defensive, very stable income. And that not only boosts the overall income potential of the portfolio, it also allows us to take on things in the equity portfolio that are maybe not so high headline yield. So they might be a bit more growth or dividend growth. And that way we get a really nice rounded solution, which is high yield, but it's not falling into the kind of traps you get with genuine pure equity high yield portfolios, which tend to be, they're quite concentrated in certain sectors. They're quite high risk often because you're chasing yield, and they give up quite a lot in terms of growth. In terms of style, you know, we try and be very style agnostic. So we will go where we see the best opportunities. And we're also extremely size agnostic. If you looked at the portfolio, you would see a real spread of everything from AstraZeneca and Shell down to, you know, sub 100 million market cap companies in there as well. And one of the nice things about being, I think, a slightly smaller trust is we don't have that liquidity problem and we can be pretty flexible.
Great. Yeah, we're going to get stuck into the allocation. Because as you say, you know, yes, you have sub 100 million market cap companies in there. But of course, you've got companies like AstraZeneca in there. So we're going to be looking at, the thinking behind that and how you manage that a little bit later on in the podcast. But one of the things that I noticed when preparing for this podcast, Ian, which was particularly interesting, was that Shires has traded at a premium. And when you're looking at the peer group, now, of course, it's a very loose peer group. As you say, if you look at the UK equity income space, of course, Shires is highly differentiated for the reasons that you've just outlined there. But still, looking and making comparisons in that space, Shires is one of, I think, maybe two, maximum three within that space that have traded at a premium recently. Many still trade at significant discounts. What would you put that down to?
So it's a great question, Jonathan. I think if we knew exactly what got us to a premium or a discount, I think we'd do it and we'd just deliver a premium. I think, there's a structural element in that it's quite a retail heavy trust. So it's quite tightly held and, people tend to hold it for quite a long period of time because they like what it does in terms of income. And that helps protect discount. Over its lifetime, certainly since I've been running it, it has generally traded at a tight discount or a small premium. And we've only had the last couple of years where I think you've seen UK equities and UK income in particular move out of favour, that we've seen that discount widen out. So it's good to see it coming back. I think performance year to date has helped. Performance has been better. I think delivery of high yield helps. Generally, we've seen things which can offer a really competitive yield ahead of cash still trade a bit more tightly on the discount. So that helps. Overall, I like to think the challenge for investment trusts at the moment is they need to do something that is genuinely adding value to end shareholders and genuinely targeting what shareholders want from the investment. And I think that's something we do really well. So I like to think that helps us trade pretty tightly and hopefully get back to a premium on a more sustainable basis.
Perfect. Thank you. So, going back to the point that we made before, that mix between small caps, mid caps and large caps, how do you go about managing this? Do you go out with preset buckets and allocations that you look for? Or is it more of a bottom up process to building the portfolio on the equity
side? Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that you end up thinking about, but you try not to think about, much like, benchmark performance. It's something where you can't help but look at the mix of the size of companies held in the portfolio. But actually, what we try and do is be genuinely size agnostic, because in theory, once you look through any liquidity issues for larger funds, there's not a huge reason why large and smaller companies should trade at different valuations. You can say large companies, they are more liquid, they might be slightly more defensive. Often smaller companies have the benefit of slightly higher growth rates. And in the current UK equity market, they have the greater potential to be acquired as well, which can be useful. So there's a reason to look at both ends of the market cap spectrum. For us, we care about all sorts of things about stocks, but generally size isn't one of them. So we screen for the things we care about. And then being, not a massive trust, it means we can buy the smaller things and hold them as well. And one of the great things about running an investment trust is that you are not at the mercy of capital outflow, which can make you a forced seller of less liquid positions over time as well. So that makes us, perfectly suited to hold some of the smaller cap things out there. It's a question we tend to get more in periods where you see a marked outperformance or underperformance of UK mid caps. And we saw that at the start of this year, for example. January and February was a period where UK mid-caps really underperformed because there was concerns about UK domestic economy. UK bond yields rose quite sharply. And the FTSE 250 correlates with bond yields very tightly. So when bond yields go up, it underperforms the 100. And that was a bit of a headwind for a couple of months. Our view tends to be that that is the kind of price moves that are driven by big index flows rather than genuine company specific fundamentals, which is what we care about. And over time, the fundamentals will win out, good companies will do better. And we're happy to look through those periods of, you know, mid-cap underperformance, as long as we're still comfortable with the companies. And indeed, the 2 months following that period, you saw UK 250s outperform very strongly as it came back again. So it's something we tend not to get too worked up about.
Fantastic. Thank you. And you mentioned in there screening, Ian, that's something that I'd like to pick up on. I'm sure listeners would be fascinated to hear a little bit more about in terms of what do you look for in a stock in terms of characteristics and what are major red flags? Of course, as an income investor, there's stocks out there with attractive yields, but in many cases that's for a reason. So it'd be good if you could touch on some of the red flags as well that you try and avoid.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's start with the things we look for. The obvious one is a high dividend yield. You know, we need to deliver a high level of income to end shareholders, and therefore we need to generate that by holding stocks that have a good yield. We don't just look at the headline dividend yield. We will look at total distribution yield, so we'll include buybacks in there as well. And then we'll look at dividend growth as well, because both of those things matter to us. That doesn't mean we won't own things that don't pay much dividend or, you know, maybe on their way to growing their dividend. It just means the bar to holding those things is quite a lot higher. The other positive things we look for, you know, we care about the quality of the companies that we invest in. We tend to think about quality as high return on capital, good market positions, ideally growing market shares, and importantly, good balance sheets. And then a bit more qualitatively, we look at the quality of the management team, because that's one thing we find that over time tends to make a big difference to your return. The challenge, I think, in finding good quality companies is that they tend to be the ones the market already rates quite highly, and that high rating feeds through into a lower dividend yield as well. So the trick is trying to find things which have a high yield, but which we still see as quality. And often that means we will find things in sectors where the market is perhaps less keen, where we might be taking on some cyclical risk or size risk to get a high yield, but still find quality. And if you think about what our perfect stock is, it tends to be something that is underappreciated quality. Red flags for us, balance sheet is one. You know, it's not a hard and fast rule, but we don't want a high level of leverage unless the company has a clear route to taking leverage down or is in a sector where running that level of leverage is sensible and standard. So that's one that's generally a red flag. Other things, you know, if we're seeing declining market shares for the company, or if we're seeing very high valuations that are based on growth out into the long term, then that's something we tend to avoid as well, because obviously your certainty as an investor when you have to roll out your time horizon reduces.
Thank you. So I'm looking at your latest fact sheet here, and I see at the top of the list of the holdings, Morgan Sindall done fantastically well for investors, including the Shire's Income Trust. Now, this is really a growth story if we're looking at the share price performance over the last year or so. So, you know, the question here is, how do you balance looking for growth and looking for income attributes within a stock when you're making your initial selections? And of course, you mentioned there in your screening process, are very much driven by quality and income attributes. So I think the question here is growth in a stock really a byproduct of selecting a high yielding, high quality share? Or do you have that at the forefront of your mind sometimes when you're looking at the initial purchases of stocks?
So I would say we don't particularly target growth. We do look for dividend growth, but absolute growth we tend to be slightly less concerned about. I think growth is probably an output of owning good quality companies with good market positions. You know, they're the ones that tend to grow through cycle over time. So I think that's definitely correct. One of the problems I think you find as an income investor is that often high yield is conversely related to growth because companies are paying out capital rather than reinvesting it. So that's an issue as an income investor you need to get around a little bit. But Morgan Sindall, you know, it's almost a kind of poster child or case study of what we're looking for in the fund. And when I talk about underappreciated quality, Morgan Sindall is absolutely that stock. Maybe less now than it was when we bought it, but it's got all those quality attributes, really, like absolutely rock solid net cash balance sheet, high return on capital, you know, really good management team. John Morgan, the founder, runs it and I think has done an exceptional job. But if you went back 5 years, you would probably struggle to find that many investors who would say Morgan Sindall or other UK engineering contractors were quality companies, because that had been a really tough sector. You know, we'd lived through blow-ups of the likes of Interserve and Carillion. And what made it interesting for me, I was the analyst covering the sector at the time, was this was just this great example of capital cycle and industry repair happening in front of you. So from our point of view, buying the sector was a big call. We own Morgan Sindall, Balfour Beatty and Kier across that sector. And after you'd seen this period of really bad performance from UK construction, you saw the companies do all the right things. You know, they took risk off the table. They changed the contract structures so risk sits with the client rather than with the company. Margins may remain relatively thin, but the margins are protected by the contracts. And balance sheet repair was completed, so they all ran with net cash balance sheets. And that set them up much better for the next upcycle in activity. And as you've then rolled into a period where the UK needs to build more houses, it needs to build more schools, you're really starting to see the spend come through on energy infrastructure, on water treatment investment, even defence spending. All of these things kind of feed into a very positive revenue dynamic for the sector. And at the same time, you've got the major client being the government saying, you know what, in the past, we gave our business to a whole range of somewhat variable companies, and some of them let us down. So what we're going to try and do is basically prioritize supporting a relatively small group of super high quality UK contractors. And in that setup, the big guys with much better business models, really good end market positions, do really well. And that's kind of what we've seen play out over the last 3 or 4 years. Morgan Sindall, I think, just has that little extra layer of really good management team and diversified business, as well as some specific areas of strength like fit out, where they've kind of outlasted some of their competitors to be a super good performer over time. Like I say, it's a really good example of what we're looking for in the portfolio.
Thank you. Thanks for a really comprehensive breakdown there. And we'll pick up on some of the other holdings a little bit later on in the podcast. But before that, I'd like to touch on the differentiated element of Shire's income and look at the allocation to fixed income products, because it actually makes up quite a significant part of the portfolio. So it'd be good, Ian, if you could speak to that, you know, the type of investments that you hold in there, and then how the holdings in these fixed income products evolve over time, and maybe if there's any catalyst that you could see on the horizon for increasing or decreasing that weighting towards these products.
Yeah, so as we've kind of covered, it's a really important differentiator in the portfolio. It's about 20% of the assets, and it just does that job of supplying really resilient high yield. If you think about what you're getting, you're kind of getting 7% plus income. And the fixed income instruments are all perpetual, so you know you are going to get paid that absent an insolvency into the future. It doesn't grow, that's a limiting factor, but it's a really high level of income. And you know, if you step back and think about the long run expected return on equities of being about 7%, actually, if you're earning almost a risk-free 7% income on these instruments, that's a really attractive part of the portfolio for what we're trying to do. The history of the fixed income bit is that it has been there for a long, long time within Shires, primarily made up of UK preference shares. And preference shares, you know, kind of sit in between debt and equity in companies' capital stacks. So if you did have an insolvency, you would have a right on the assets ahead of the equity holders, which gives you a bit more protection. And generally, for a company to pay out a dividend to the equity holders, if they have preference shares, they have to be paying out to their preference shareholders as promised ahead of that. So your risk of a dividend cut is quite low. And then if you do have a dividend cut in the preference shares, as we've seen with one holding, you are actually due the arrears back afterwards. So you make it back when the company recovers. So all of that means high yield, very resilient, just doesn't deliver growth or income growth. As we've kind of moved over time, generally the holdings have been very stable. You know, the perpetual nature of them means you don't really need to buy and sell them particularly. But we have seen preference shares retired by UK financial institutions, and generally no one issues them anymore because they don't count in a particularly advantageous way for financial capital positions, and they're quite expensive to issue. So that means we've diversified a little bit into perpetual debt in some financials as well, where we're getting a high yield that gives you a very similar outcome to the preference shares, basically. In terms of what would make us buy and sell these, you know, I think they tend to react primarily to UK interest rate expectations. So that is exactly as you would expect. If interest rates and bond yields go down, these go up in value and vice versa. You know, if we ever live through a period where we get ultra low interest rates, as we saw in the last cycle again, then we would expect valuations to go up and we'd probably reduce our weight in fixed income and put it into equities, because you would say you were at the top of the valuation cycle for those. Conversely, you know, if we see UK bond yields rise dramatically and the yields on the fixed income element grow to a level that is, you know, materially high, maybe we take some more, particularly if we want to take some risk off the table as well. But our view tends to be that it's a stable part of the portfolio that does something important and differentiates the trust. So we don't usually trade around it too much.
Yes, very difficult to argue against a steady 7% yield. So I completely understand your thinking there. So we've discussed Morgan Sindall, Ian. Let's now please move on to some of the other holdings. What have you been buying recently? And could you, if you have any favourites, could you highlight some of your favourite longer-term holdings within the portfolio, please?
Yeah, I mean, this question, where do you start, really? They're all my favourites. Let's start with what we've been buying recently, because that's always, I think, interesting as to where we're seeing value and what looks good. You know, like I say, we've always got to try and find those opportunities to find decent businesses with high yields. And often, from our point of view, that means buying some things that are more cyclical and trying to do it at the bottom of the cycle. And the market generally doesn't like cyclical companies. It tends to struggle a little bit with how to value them. And if you're running an open-ended fund, you don't necessarily want too many very cyclical companies, because you might have to sell them at the wrong point in the cycle. That's what you don't want to do. From our point of view, what matters in cyclical companies is that we try and buy them near the bottom, and they will pay us a yield while we hold them. And then hopefully we can sell them somewhere near the top of the cycle, or when we've seen some price recovery. And we try and keep the mindset that over that holding period, the company fundamentals and the company market position and the balance sheet matters. but the share price doesn't matter so much, right? You know, we can let it go up and down with the cycle. And at the moment, I think we've probably found some things that have been clear cyclical opportunities, which is, it's not surprising because we've had such a volatile year so far. You know, if you look back over the first half of the year, some of the events you've seen, even, you know, things that are forgotten, like the impact of DeepSeek on AI, the start of the US presidency, the impact of tariffs, war in the Middle East, etc. All these things are kind of, in any normal year, would be a huge event. And they've caused some pretty big gyrations in markets, which have created some opportunities. In terms of stock specifics, one thing we bought a month or so ago was Midwich, which is a UK small cap company. And they do basically audio visual equipment supply to corporates. And it's actually a business with a really good market position, historically very good growth record, run by the founder who obviously knows it extremely well. We generally, we do kind of like founder run businesses often. But it's had a super tough cycle because if you rewind back to the pandemic, obviously, everyone went through that experience, decided video conferencing was the way forward, and acquired a lot of AV equipment, as you would. Great time for Midwich. If you look at the share price, it did really well in kind of 2020, 2021. But obviously, what that means is then you have a cycle where corporates don't go and buy new kit for quite a period of time because this stuff lasts for a while. And if we look back over recent years, the shares are down by about 2/3. It's trading with a 6% yield and a 9x earnings ratio. So it is very much the low end of its historic range. That's interesting because you've got a business which is underlying good quality, but at a low multiple, at also a cyclical low for its earnings. And when we start to look forwards, actually, you're getting to the point in the equipment cycle where people are going to start replacing kit. We're seeing that come through. We're seeing business appetite to do that. And as you see more people being back in the office and driving office demand, actually, there's a real opportunity there to hold it. And we can be a bit patient for that cycle to turn and the business to pick up again. And with that yield, we're paid to wait. So one we think is really interesting here. If we look, you know, another cyclical one we bought recently was Victrex, which is a UK chemical company. They make PEEK, which is basically a very durable, hard plastic product. And that's a company which has also been through a cyclical trough. You've seen kind of margins get compressed, as they will do in chemical companies. But it's maintained a pretty strong market position. It's maintained a cost advantage. It's put a lot of capex into building capacity in China at a cost advantage position, which is now going to roll off. So we're going to see free cash flow expand. And then we're seeing a pickup in some of their higher margin end markets. So healthcare is one where you use this stuff in joint replacements, for example. And they're also growing a new market in subsea pipes, where actually having, you know, really durable plastic pipes compared to traditional steel ones is very advantageous. And that's a nice set of potential growth. It's another stock that's fallen by about 2/3 from its recent highs. And we think if we hold it for now, can be a very attractive return. And then maybe at the other end of the kind of cyclicality, two names we actually think are decent quality businesses where we've probably looked at them for a while. One is Informa. So it does exhibitions, publishing, data services. And it's a business that is very good at doing bolt-on acquisitions, compounding up over time. And that gets reflected in really good compound dividend growth if you look back over time. So it's one that when we bought it only has about 3.5% dividend yield, so in line with the market, but the dividend growth track record and potential is very good. And that sold off in April when you had a spike in Middle East conflict, because they have quite an exposure to the Middle East exhibition market. for us, that's one we've been looking at for quite a while. Great opportunity to buy it when the valuation was low. And I think it's had a good recovery already, actually. It was about 15% since we bought it. But just a really good business to own, where it's always been a bit of a struggle to find the in price. And then the last new one, which everyone will know, is Greggs, so the popular sandwich and sausage roll chain. And that is one where we held it in the fund until last summer. We sold it because we thought the valuation was quite full and the yield had compressed. And since we sold it, the share price has halved. And there is some reason for the share price being lower. You know, we are seeing weaker consumer demand, and that's being reflected in like-for-likes. We're seeing some cost inflation pressure as well. But our belief would be that the actual business model here is far from broken. You know, good offering, very popular with consumers at an attractive price point, and with a very disciplined rollout strategy that is still ongoing. I don't think it should have been worth the kind of 21 times earnings it was trading on middle of last year. But at half that multiple, with growth continuing, once you get through a bit of consumer softness, I think that's something that which will re-rate from here and kind of reassert its quality credentials as well. So they're the four most recent ones. Should we talk about long-term favorites, maybe?
Yes, please.
And, you know, we covered the construction names. In terms of sectors, we've been long-term holders of the UK banks. So we've kind of moved in and out of NatWest, Barclays, Lloyds over time, and they've all done extremely well over the last 5 years. For us, that was a really obvious trade that interest rates needed to move up. The banks were being valued at half times book at the bottom of the cycle, and it's kind of played out as we expected, to be honest. It's been a really nice trade in UK banks, and we continue to hold Lloyds and Barclays. They continue to have very good hedge positions, which means you'll see interest income grow still over the next 3 years, and they look very well set. The bank that I was going to call out as a long-term holding, which we still really like, is Standard Chartered. And that's a great example of a business which was deemed relatively low quality by the market, but which has been through a real corporate repair journey where they've sold off the low return bits of the business. They've refocused on what they're good at, which is kind of global transaction banking and the kind of trade and intermarket flows in the Far East, which are very important. And then they've managed to grow a really impressive Asian wealth business as well, which is very high return on capital, growing really strongly, and is actually a much better quality business than you would think if you just look at the multiple that Standard Chartered trades on. So as we move forward, we think it will continue to deliver decent growth. Returns will continue to move up. It will be somewhat cyclical, like all banks are, but it's a really nice opportunity to get growth at a very reasonable price. And then the other sector where we've tended to have quite a high weighting has been energy. As I've kind of alluded to, we're happy to take cyclical risk, which means we can take some energy exposure. But we generally don't like the kind of unpredictable cyclical risk that comes with the oil price too much. And that tends to also put dividends under threat. So where we have energy holdings, we kind of take advantage of the discount the market applies to that sector, but we try and find things that protect their dividend flows a bit better than that. And one thing we've held for, I'm going to say the last 5 years, is a company called Diversified Energy, which runs mature gas wells in the US. And they've got this great track record of just buying up old gas wells that people no longer want to run, making them much more efficient, delivering better production. And the nice thing is it's very predictable, low decline rate production. So you have a very high visibility on gas production. They also hedge out their pricing up to 2 years ahead. So you have very high visibility on what price you're getting. And therefore you get pretty stable cash flow generation over time. And what makes it, I think, particularly interesting for us is that although the market trades it up and down based on what US gas prices do, we would see some pretty strong structural drivers for better US gas prices as we look forward. You know, you've got strong demand from domestic consumption. You've got increasing power demand, and particularly as you see data centers developed, you're seeing a lot more gas usage in the US. And then you've got a really significant build out of export capacity on the US Gulf Coast, taking gas and liquefying it and shipping it over to Europe. And if you saw the trade deal signed with the EU this week, you would have seen part of that was a really massive commitment to buy gas from the US. And all of that is going to shift the supply demand balance in the US in favor of slightly higher gas prices, and Diversified will be a great beneficiary of that. And at the same time, they're doing the kind of clever things you would want to see about tying in with data center operators, extracting low carbon gas from coal mines, doing all the things that just give them some additional upside on top of that. So it's a company we really like. The share prices have been quite volatile, but if you look in total return terms, it's been a really nice performer over 5 years.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ian. I've got a lot of questions about those portfolio companies. I think we could probably do another podcast or two discussing those. So thank you very much for those comprehensive breakdowns. But to finish off now, as a UK equity focused manager, you know, looking at what's happening out there in the world at this point in time, what excites you the most about the year ahead?
Well, I'd almost like a bit less excitement if I'm honest, Jonathan. I think that would be a nice thing. You know, what excites me? I think just generally what excites me in this job is meeting great management teams where you see their enthusiasm for their business and their optimism for the year ahead. And I think at the moment, we meet a lot of management teams who are, you know, they're doing a great job. Their companies are performing really well, but the market doesn't always recognize that. And UK equities generally still trade at a really material discount to the rest of the world. I think over the next year, as we see that kind of equity allocation broaden out away from US tech somewhat into other markets, the UK is just a great place to benefit from that. You know, it's everyone is underweight in the UK, but it is performing well. The kind of headwinds are slowly being removed. You can see, you know, the trade deal with the US is better than the EU. The corporate balance sheet in the UK is pretty strong. The consumer balance sheet is pretty strong. And it doesn't take much to just shift the mood music in the UK into one that is a bit more positive. And suddenly I think we have a pretty good outcome here. But a bit of stability would actually be super helpful.
Yes. I mean, certainly with what's happened so far this year, I think everybody would welcome some stability. So Ian, thank you very much. And just a note to listeners, do check out the notes to this podcast, because there'll be a link through to the Shires Income Investment Trust Centre on the UK Investor Magazine website. You'll be able to find latest fact sheets and some videos as well to get a greater insight into the trust. So Ian, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Jonathan, thank you so much for your time. It's been a great pleasure.
And thank you very much to everyone for listening. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember, all investment involves risk.